degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 63 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. I'm Parisa Neruzzi, and this is Taking Action on WPFW 89.3 FM. We come to you every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, bringing information and inspiration so that you can take action in our city to fight displacement, save our schools and communities, stand up for justice, build our power, and hold government officials accountable. Taking Action is produced by the grassroots organization Empower DC. We welcome your feedback and your show ideas. You can call Empower DC at 202-234-9119 or go to empowerdc.org for more information. As I start today's show, first of all, I want to say hi to the listeners. I hope you're doing well on this beautiful fall day. We are not quite yet into the fall pledge drive for WPFW, but it is starting on October 14th. And I do want to encourage folks to make a contribution to the to help sustain this very important station. You can go ahead and get your donations in early at WPFWFM.org. Every time we do a pledge drive, I'm reminded of how critical it is that we come together to sustain and support Black-owned and Black-led institutions in Washington, D.C. And WPFW is absolutely one of those important priority institutions, especially as DC has faced intense gentrification and displacement of Black residents and communities. And while many of us think of gentrification as a more recent phenomenon over the last couple of decades, the truth is that there have been earlier waves of gentrification and displacement of Black residents from multiple communities across the district, like Georgetown, where my guests today continue to sustain and support a very critical, important Black institution. The Mount Zion United Methodist Church in Georgetown is celebrating its 208th anniversary this year. I have to stop and think to myself, what must have DC been like 208 years ago? I'm so happy to welcome today's guests who will share some of the incredible story of Mount Zion and let us know how we can join in the celebration. So today, my guests include the pastor at Mount Zion, Reverend Selena M. Johnson, the church historian, Miss Dolores Green, anniversary event co-coordinator, Miss Valerie Twyman will be joining us, and the anniversary event media coordinator, Miss Alice Walker. And I'd especially like to thank Ms. Walker for helping to produce today's show. I got to know her through her efforts to bring about environmental justice in DC in the Brentwood community. And I'm so grateful for all of her contributions to our city. So thank you all so much for joining Taking Action. And I would love for you all to each start by briefly sharing your intro and your personal connection to Mount Zion, if you wouldn't mind. Happy to have Reverend Johnson.
Yes, well, thank you so much, Parisa and WPFW for inviting us here. We're very excited to be a part of this broadcast. And I came to Mount Zion in 2019 and was appointed by our bishop there as the pastor. And it was unknown to me, even though I had been in the DC area for 30 years, I didn't know that this church was in Georgetown. I didn't know the history of Black Georgetown either. And so as I came and prayed and looked at this, I said, how did this church get here? And then through the years have been discovering the amazing history of Mount Zion. So it's been a little over 5 years, and I'm just happy and pleased to be a part of this community.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Ms. Green?
Hi, I'm Dolores Green, and for about the past 5 years, I have been serving as the Mount Zion Church historian. I was introduced to Mount Zion as a baby. My great-grandmother, grandmother, and parents all attended Mount Zion, and had at times early on, they had lived in Georgetown. They then moved to, my great-grandmother then moved to Foggy Bottom for a while. And then after Foggy Bottom, my family moved uptown to where the U Street corridor is. And that's where my dad basically grew up. And I grew up in Northeast Washington. I'd like to let you know, not only were we Native Washingtonians, but we're at least four generations of federal workers within Washington. And that's just not that unusual, considering that we've had early members of Mount Zion who also worked in the federal government during the antebellum years.
Well, you named some very fabulous DC neighborhoods. And, you know, as we talk about, especially the story of DC natives, we often hear families that have been forced at times to move from Georgetown to, you know, some of the other communities that you mentioned, and then now, unfortunately, sometimes out of the city. But we'll get into that. Ms. Walker, I'd love to hear your brief intro in connection to the church.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Alice Walker. I am a native Washingtonian, a retired federal employee for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, where I was the environmental justice coordinator for over 20 years for the Office of Water, working for the assistant administrator in policy. I attended Mount Zion as Sunday school. My grandmother used to bring me and my brother by our hands and deliver us to the lower level of the church every Sunday. Miss Garner was the Sunday school teacher. My family has attended Mount Zion since the late 1800s.
Wow. Well, thank you again, all of you, for being on today. And I'm so excited to learn about this history, this amazing history of Mount Zion. Founded in 1816, and again, the oldest African-American congregation in D.C., so I would love to hear a bit of that history of how this church was founded. Who would like to start?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about that. During the oppressive years of slavery, 125 free and enslaved Black Christians left the Montgomery Street Church in Georgetown, and that's now Dumbarton United Methodist Church. And they decided they wanted to have a church of their own. Mm-hmm. While worshiping and I'm going to use the current names of these churches, while worshiping at Dumbarton, they were subjected to all types of discrimination. They were segregated with regard to seating. They were relegated to a very small balcony when they made up nearly one half of the congregation. They had to wait to partake of the sacraments until after all of the white members had been served. And because of these reasons, they felt that it would be better to have their own church. And after some discussions that took place over a period of 4 years, the meeting house, now known as Mount Zion United Methodist Church, was founded. The church was located up at 27th and P Street, Northwest, and it was attended by most of the people who lived in the neighborhood. Now, because these members were free and enslaved, not everybody who was Black, who even lived in the area, was able to go, because if you were enslaved, your time was not your own. We did have enslaved members as well. 2 months after Mount Zion was founded, the American Colonization Society was also founded in December of 1816. And the Methodist Episcopal Church was an ardent supporter of that organization. And they tried to recruit as many free Black Methodists as possible to go to Africa. And they also tried to recruit, that included our minister, the Reverend Joseph Cartwright, and one of our leading lay leaders, Dr. James Fleet. In fact, Dr. Fleet's medical training at what is now George Washington University was paid for by the American Colonization Society. But they were in their own church now, and I think it gave them the gumption to say, to stand up to the Methodist Episcopal Church, and they said, no, we're not going to go. And instead, these two men became civil rights activists in their own right. Dr. James Fleet was a member of the National Negro Convention movement, which was a large group of organizations throughout the country that would meet to try to abolish slavery and also to oppose the American Colonization Society. Reverend Joseph Cartwright, on the other hand, also had to buy his entire family out of slavery. He traveled up and down the East Coast. He worked with abolitionists such as Charles Torrey and to buy the freedom of others. And these were not the only people in the congregation who did this. In other words, as they were fighting for freedom, people, they worked hard, they took their savings, and every now and then I understand that the plate was passed in the congregation to buy people out of slavery. As much as we worked toward trying to free people, Mount Zion United Methodist Church at that time was also interested in educating people. So a Sabbath school was established in 1823 at Mount Zion. And this included children, men, and women, which was unusual for women to be able to go to school, and free and enslaved. And of course, as I said before, the enslaved were there only with the permission of their enslavers. Mount Zion became more than just a church. It was a cultural center within Georgetown at that time. And Black people, free and enslaved, made up about one third of all of Georgetown. Over where the church is located, that's an area called Herring Hill. That had a much higher percentage of Black people living there. Until the end of slavery and DC emancipation, these members were very active, not only opposing slavery, but they were also active in building a community. They owned businesses. They also had not only doctors there, but other professional people lived in Georgetown and were members of the church. And they all supported each other. It's a very supportive neighborhood. Once emancipation occurred within DC in 1862, public schools came into being, and many of our members supported the public schools. Again, Reconstruction was over around 1874. Segregation was instituted within Washington, and then Mount Zion became not only a church, but also a social and cultural center. Plays were held there. Oratorical contests for young people were held there. Mount Zion acquired a community house in the 1920s, and we had the first lending library within Georgetown there. I could possibly just go on and on about so many of the actions and activities that the Mount Zion was involved in during that period. But I would like to mention something about gentrification, because by the 1930s, it was during the Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration, that's when the gentrification started. And many of our members took their own actions. We had Mr. Morgan Brown Sr., for example, wanted to buy the house that he was renting. It was for sale. However, unlike many of the new white residents who were coming in, he was not able to purchase it because of the lending practices within there. By 1950, in addition to the restrictive covenants, the old Georgetown Act, as you mentioned earlier, was being put into place. Our minister, Reverend James D. Foy, went to Congress to talk about the impact on people's lives, whereas the old Georgetown Act was much more concerned about ensuring that the colonial architecture would remain within Georgetown. Reverend Foy talked about people. Of course, his views fell on deaf ears. Many of the Congress people that he was speaking to when he was testifying, they lived in Georgetown. And as far as they were concerned, this was much more of a social issue and a cultural issue. And as far as they were concerned, architecture was much more important than people. Despite these challenges, Mount Zion has continued within Georgetown. There was talk at one time about, oh, well, maybe we should move the church. But that didn't happen. We decided to stay, and that's where we are today. And hopefully we will talk a little bit more about what's going on with Mount Zion now that we're in the 21st century.
Thank you so much for that overview. What an incredible history, and there's so much that we want to dig into and learn a little more. We have been joined by our fourth guest, Miss Valerie Twyman, co-coordinator of the anniversary event coming up here, and we're going to talk about that. Miss Twyman, thank you for joining us, and would you mind just briefly introducing yourself and sharing your connection to Mount Zion? You're muted. So as soon as
there we go. Now, thank you.
Wonderful.
My name is Valerie Logan. I have been a member at Mount Zion United Methodist Church from a babe to an adult. I am currently this year. I am the coordinator for the 208th anniversary at Mount Zion United Methodist Church. And this year we have some wonderful events that will be taking place leading up to our anniversary. And as we continue to try to lead up to our milestone of the 210-year anniversary. Mm-hmm. So we are doing a lot of marvelous things. Mm-hmm. In fact, on Sunday, it will be our actual anniversary celebration, as well as our ribbon cutting ceremony. We have a ribbon cutting ceremony, and we'll have a dedication service with that as well. Our guest speaker on Sunday will be Reverend Jaleesa Hall, and she's going to bring us a dynamite message, I know, because she's been here before. Also, we will be having on October the 27th, we will have our student day, and we factor a lot on our students because our students is our future church. It keeps us connected in the community, as well as to continue to try to build the church so that we won't move or we won't have to move. We'll have a future church in front of us. And then after that, we will have a orchestra concert that will be taking place on November the 17th. And they will be featuring Ashley Peoples, the organist, as well as our very own Ronald Trey Watson, who is an organist in Mount Zion as well. So those who would like to join us, you're more than welcome to come out. We're located in Georgetown, as we all talk about, and we're at 1334 29th Street Northwest, and our services will begin at 10 a.m.
Thank you so much. I noticed that you do have those details on your website, Mount Zion, umcdc.org, just mtzionumcdc.org. But we'll definitely remind the listeners again before we close out today. So thanks. It sounds like a wonderful series of events. We were just hearing from Ms. Green about the history of Mount Zion, and I wanted to ask Reverend Johnson and Ms. Walker if you wanted to mention any of the elements of the history that you feel most moved and inspired by.
Well, I guess I'll start off. I guess the thing that amazes me is that some of the people who are older members who are here, they still remember living here in Georgetown when it was more of an integrated community and one-third African-American, and they could walk to the church, and just their stories about how it was are so impactful and powerful. But also, there's a lot of trauma involved as well, because they remember how, you know, on certain houses they were placing green stickers or just saying this property is condemned because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't match up to our architectural standards now. And all of a sudden, their home that they had been in for generations is now, you know, kind of forced to move out. And, you know, just dealing with that trauma, I think they're still very proud and happy that at least the church is still here. And, you know, and that's why, you know, I think that really inspires me to keep us going and holding on, even though we're a small member congregation, because again, we had to begin becoming commuters because people moved outside of the area, and instead of walking to church, now everybody's commuting. And then at one point there was a bus, and they were bringing people in by buses, you know, to keep it going. So there's been just a determination to keep us going. And of course, we've just been blessed to keep on going. And now after pandemic, we learned about how we can also have virtual members. And so we even have one member all the way in North Carolina now. And she still comes in on the virtual and still comes in on her committees and helps out. So, you know, we are determined to survive, but not just to survive, but to thrive and keep the legacy alive. So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you. Yeah, it takes a lot of commitment to keep any institution going when it's all led by members, right? All led by essentially volunteer members, right, who've come together. And that's something that I find so powerful about the Black church in particular, is that this is an institution that groups of people came together, pooled their resources, right, created these facilities that, like you spoke to, Ms. Green, are not just about worship, although that's an important component, but about all sides of community life, right? So I really value that. Ms. Walker, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the history and things that stand out to you.
Sure. Well, I think about my great-grandfather and grandmother, John and Della Marshall, who in 1920 purchased 3206 O Street, which is the store that we had in our family for over 90 years. And then he also purchased 3226, 3228, and 3230 O Street. That's at Wisconsin and O Street. He had, there'd been a myth that Black people who lived in Georgetown didn't own property, were not business owners. And I have the photos and the deeds and the census records and all, as well as I was, when they sold the store, I've received some of the proceeds from family proceeds, you know, from the estate. So it's well documented that he owned the property. The property was a hat cleaning and shoe shine, and he did hauling. And he actually did, he had a contract with Georgetown University, and he hauled the students' luggage from the Union Station to the university. The store, which he was not aware of when he purchased it, was once a slave holding block. They would hold the slaves in the store's basement and then march the slaves across the street, High Street, at the time, which is now Wisconsin Avenue, to a slave trading block where John Beasley ran a slave trading company or whatever. But that was some of the history we were not aware of. It was Georgetown University that gave us that bit of history. In fact, across the street, immediately across the street from the store at 3206 O Street is a plaque, a bronze plaque that talks about my great-grandfather and talks about the slavery that was going on, the selling of slaves that was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. And it's from my understanding that Francis Scott Key once lived in one of the homes. Of course, that was way before my great-grandfather purchased it. But at Georgetown, a lot of people don't realize we had doctors, we had lawyers, we had business owners, and it was a very thriving, proud place to live. At one time, in fact, I say they were even today that we are holding it down. We're still holding it down in Georgetown. That's my saying that I have about where we are and what's going on. But Georgetown, as we know it now, 20 years ago. And up until now, it was just a thriving place. You went to go shopping, you went to go eating, and all. And frequently I ride a Lyft, and I always ask the driver, do you have any idea that Georgetown used to have a large Black population? And it's so surprising how many people have no idea. And if I'm going on my way to Georgetown University Hospital, we usually go down P Street, and I point up off of P Street to where our cemetery is. And I say, you see back there, that's where the Black cemetery is. And then I give them the story about Dumbarton didn't want us buried in the same cemetery with them, our church. And so it was land that, and Dolores can give more information on this, land that was given to us or purchased so that Blacks could be buried in one area and the whites that were with Dumbarton would be buried in another. So they even had us separated and segregated in death. Against the odds, of hard labor and slavery and harsh physical, political, legal, and educational limitations, we thrived as a people in Georgetown. It was a happy time. Sometimes it's like at Christmas, you say, we didn't know we were poor. You hear people say that. Well, in Georgetown, in the midst of all of those things, people were still very proud of and they came together as a community at our church at Mount Zion. So those are some of the things that I wanted to share.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad that I'm glad that Alice mentioned Francis Scott Key, because most people think of him writing the poem Star Spangled Banner, but he was also an attorney, the District of Columbia. And one of the things he did was he prepared charges against a Mount Zion member back in 1837. Her name was Dorcas Allen. And Dorcas Allen had been living with her husband, Nathan, and four children as a free woman in 1837. When the notorious slave dealer, James Birch, somehow acquired the rights to sell Dorcas Allen and her children. Mm-hmm. And whilst Francis Scott Key did not prosecute the case, he did prepare all of the documents. Now, Dorcas Allen, rather than to have her children sold into slavery, she started murdering her children after Birch had put them in a slave pen in Alexandria. She succeeded in murdering the two oldest ones, killing them. The two youngest ones. There was a trial that was held. Ms. Allen was found not guilty due to incompetence, but she was still property. She was turned back over to James Birch for sale. Her husband frantically went everywhere to try to raise money to buy his wife and his children. And it was not unusual for Black people to buy their relatives, to buy friends and so forth. But in this case, he was under a time crunch because of the fact that she was for sale. Among the people who donated to him was John Quincy Adams. By that time, he was the former president of the United States and he was a sitting congressman. But John Quincy Adams gave $50. Finally, Nathan Allen raised $475. He was able to free his wife and his two children. And as you can imagine, as soon as the manumission papers were documented and registered with the District of Columbia government, he left Washington and moved to Rhode Island.
And I'd like to add one thing. Just to let you know, we do still have Blacks that still live in Georgetown. Mm-hmm. And one of the families, I know of, it's Janice Davis's family, they still own their home in Georgetown.
Yeah.
There are, in fact, a couple of other members as well are still there.
Yeah, one of the things that really struck me in your description of the founding of the church was the fact that it was enslaved and free Black people coming together. And I think that sense of, you know, solidarity among different, you know, folks that are going through different things economically, and of course, this incredible just injustice and oppression that was happening. And then that you said that sometimes they would pass the plate during service to help fund the freeing of people, right? And I find that just to be, you know, it gives me goosebumps. And I wonder what are some other ways? I know I heard mention of the church playing a role in the Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned the cemeteries, but I think you have, there's a connection, right? That yes. Maybe you guys can tell a little bit of that story.
Well, if you look at our old archives, you'll see names. And then next to these names, you'll see things like gone away, lost. And you're saying, well, what happened here? Well, as fugitives were coming into Georgetown and they were looking for a place to hide, Mount Zion was part of the Underground Railroad. So many times we would adopt them as members, and you could, and some of these little words, lost, meant probably they did not have a good outcome as far as getting to their destination. But gone away meant, oh, they probably made it to the next station. And in addition to becoming, you know, quasi members, we had to figure out a place to put these members. So there's a cemetery that's now Mount Zion Cemetery. Previously, at that time, it was called the Old Methodist Burying Ground, and it was the property of the Dumbarton United Methodist Church. And there, within that cemetery, there were Black people who were buried, and we're not quite sure whether they were actually segregated in the cemetery or not. But at any rate, that there was a vault that during the winter months, when the ground was hard and you couldn't necessarily bury people, the vault had bodies in it. And mm-hmm. this is where some of the fugitives, the enslaved fugitives, would go. Sometimes they would be there overnight. We believe that others may have stayed, you know, as long as a week or two. They had to wait until it was clear. Mm-hmm. And it's good that you brought that up, because I think it gives some light on the Underground Railroad with regard to, it wasn't just hiding people because we have some sort of facility, but you had to know a lot about the landscape. It was more of a logistical effort. Almost like in wartime, you know, and in a way, we were fighting a war. We were fighting a war for freedom.
Mm. So. Yeah.
And also, because they were in the vault, then the slave catchers would, you know, just run right on past the vault, thinking there's nothing in there but dead people. Mm. And Mount Zion members would bring them the runaways as food and shelter, as food and clothing and all, even to take for the next station, you know, to get them to the next station, to keep them warm and what have you.
And at that time, it wasn't our property. It belonged to Dumbarton United Methodist Church. So because it was being controlled by white people, it was that was also one way of ensuring that it wasn't looked at as closely as some other locations mm-hmm. might be. Mm.
But yeah, I understand.
Parisa, that... we did a really fun movie where Alice was our co-producer on, called Celebrating Freedom. We kind of did a docudrama about what some of these stories might have been like. You know, we add dramatization to it, what some of these stories might have been like of people trying to hide in the Mount Zion congregation or actually in the vault. And we actually filmed in the vault, and that came out in 2022. So a very powerful history involved with that.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, we also had a real African-American Civil War enactors. We had the female reenactors of distinction freed. And we had one guy who actually was in the movie Glory that was that participated or was one of the cast members for the film. So, and then it was actually tracing the history of Mount Zion from 1816 to, I believe that was 2022 or 2021 at the time. And so we went from the very beginning of breaking away from the church all the way to now. Mm-hmm. And we featured the choir, mm-hmm. The marvelous Mount Zion choir, mm-hmm. And just all the way up to the things that we're doing now in the church. So it was a labor of love, but it was a lot of fun. It was celebrating freedom and the historic journey of the oldest Black congregation in Washington, D.C.
Well, we'll have to partner up and do a screening of that together so that we can make sure that the listeners get to see it. Reverend Johnson, I would love for you to speak a little bit more about, I know you talked earlier about how some of the things that you've done, that the congregation has done to keep itself going and, you know, not lose the site. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the current activities that you all are running at the church?
Yes, sure. So we are a small member congregation. I say we're small but powerful, and I like how Alice says it. We're holding it down in Georgetown. And one of the things that really keeps us strong is the partnerships that we have with other organizations and the community around us. So again, like Celebrating Freedom, we partnered with the enactors and all of those things. And it keeps those relationships and keep us vital and keep us active. We just recently finished this big renovation in our fellowship hall, and that was supported by neighbors around us. We did a fundraiser with Dumbarton House, which is, you know, another organization that's nearby in Georgetown. We had fundraisers at our neighbors' houses. We had people to come in and have a history tour of the church, and they donated and helped us tremendously to get this renovation match. Because what happened was we became one of 15 churches, one of 15 houses of worship that was chosen by the National Trust to be a part of this very special program called Sacred Places. Mm-hmm. And so we were in the 2021 cohort, and we were in there with like the National Cathedral and other places. So this is very prestigious award that's given like throughout the nation. But in order to get the grant, we had to raise matching funds. And so we went to our neighbors, we went to our community partners, and they helped us. We have a playgroup here in town that's been here for like 60 years, where a lot of the Georgetown little tiny people come, they're 1 and 2 year olds or even younger than that. And then, so they're here, and they helped contribute. They raised funds, and local churches, other churches helped us raise funds for this. So we're very, very excited that at this 208th anniversary on Sunday, we get to cut the ribbon officially and do the dedication of this newly renovated fellowship hall. We also use it to for outreach. We use it to give out meals to shelter challenged folks every Saturday. But that's also like our church can't do it every Saturday. So other churches come in and they bring the food. We're the we're the site host every Saturday, but other churches come in and host the food. So we have partners with them, and they're part of the Georgetown Ministry Center, which we like to support them as well to help those who are struggling with homelessness. They don't have places to live. And so we're very proud that that's going into it. So it'll be 11 years in November that we've been doing this program. Mm-hmm. And when the previous pastor, when they started this program, they said, there's no way this is going to work. Maybe it'll last for a year. And now it's been 11 years. So see how look at God working through us, in and through us. And so those are just some of the things. We have a community orchestra that's brand new that our organist, Ronald Trey Walton, has started. So the way we keep it vibrant is to keep in partnership and in relationship with others. I would say that's sort of the main thing.
That's wonderful. And I noticed that you have is it a sister organization that's doing a lot of the preservation work on the cemetery? I know Lisa Fager and the work that mm-hmm. she does with you all. Mm-hmm. Do you want to speak briefly about that as well?
There is a board of directors for the Mount Zion and Female Union Bands Society cemeteries. When they're actually two cemeteries, but for many years, both of them were considered Mount Zion Cemetery. And that is because the Female Union Band Society Cemetery, which was founded in 1842, was founded mostly by Mount Zion women. But if you look at the paperwork in the archives, you'll find that it's signed by Mount Zion men. And that's mainly because at that time, women weren't recognized to be capable of managing something like a cemetery. And what our board of directors has done is to call in folks to, we have archaeologists coming in, anthropologists coming in, deep penetrating radar to try to figure out where all of these bodies are located. The cemeteries for many years went untended. And at that time, not only was there just overgrowth and so forth, but also there were so much disrespect within the community. For the cemeteries. Many of the headstones were removed. In fact, we just replaced a headstone that was found in Virginia, and brought back to Mount Zion. We were able to contact the family members. There was a ceremony that was held there. Lisa Fager has done a fantastic job as our executive director as far as getting the word out mm-hmm. as to, you know, what happened to the cemeteries and what it's going to take to maintain them. So we're developing a strategic plan to make sure that there's perpetual care now for all of those people who are there. They weren't respected when they were alive, so we're trying to give them the respect that they deserve now.
Mm. And I believe Lisa regularly hosts tours and info sessions about the history, so folks can look that up online and get involved.
Absolutely. And in fact, even if Lisa's not at the cemetery, we now have
QR code. Yeah, you can take a self-guided tour.
I mean, you come up to the cemetery, you'll see the sign there. And you can just put your phone up there and take the self-guided tour. So I ask anyone who is interested to please do that. And also, as it was mentioned, we have a partnership with Dumbarton House. Every year, we have people to come in who buy Christmas wreaths. And we make sure that all of the graves have wreaths at Christmas time. And this is Dumbarton House is managing that. And that is also on the Mount Zion Female Union Band Society organization website.
Dolores, what's the exact address so people know how to get to the cemetery?
The cemetery is at 27th and R Street Northwest, right on Mill, the little street called Mill Road. Mm-hmm. That's there. So, And you'll see the signs now. And also, it's right next to Dumbarton House, in case you're familiar mm-hmm. with Dumbarton, which is a huge facility.
So you mentioned earlier that there was decades of litigation to prevent the cemeteries from being sold. What was the force, if you can say it? What was who was trying to force the sale of the cemeteries?
Well, primarily real estate developers.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. But yeah.
Primarily real estate developers. I mean, it started in the 1950s about what to do with the cemeteries. The Mount Zion Cemetery was really only leased to Mount Zion. It was the property of Dumbarton United Methodist Church. And sometimes when Dumbarton got into financial trouble, they might think, oh, we might want to sell the cemetery. Mm-hmm. Usually that did not, obviously that did not happen. But the Female Union Band Society Cemetery was also, there was talk of selling that cemetery. And finally, members of the community, mainly Neville Waters II, who's had a very long history, not only in Georgetown, but in Mount Zion, the Turner family. He stepped in, even though his mother was a member of the Female Union Band Society, and that group had decided they were going to sell the cemetery. So we had that to take place. The National Bicentennial Commission stepped in to support making sure that the cemeteries remained. Vincent DeForest, who was the CEO at that time in the 1970s, 1976 to be exact, he pushed this whole effort. So, I mean, we were on TV. We were in the newspaper, so we got a lot of publicity. And finally, as it went through various court cases, it was part of various court cases, finally in 1977, it was decided that these cemeteries would not be sold. And that's when we came up in 2005, we had a permanent board to oversee the cemeteries, because it was just really difficult for the church to maintain both cemeteries for perpetual care. And now Lisa's done a great job of making sure we've gotten, you know, funding to help with that.
Yeah. Wow. That was a big battle y'all took on. And it just speaks to the spirit of the church and all the folks within it, that you have a vision. I want to ask Ms. Twyman if you could repeat again the information for the celebration. And then as we close the show, I'd love to just hear your thoughts for the future of Mount Zion and, you know, maybe one or two things that you hope will come. But yeah, Ms. Twyman, could you invite the listeners again to the big celebration?
Sure. We will have our church anniversary this Sunday on October the 13th. Our worship service is at 10 o'clock. Our speaker this year will be Jaleesa Hall. And during that time, after that, we will have our ribbon cutting ceremony, the dedication to the fellowship hall, where the sacred places have joined in with Mount Zion to make that happen. As well as the 2 weeks after that, we will have our student Sunday on October the 27th, the students will be recognized, our teachers. Some of them have become principals. And so it's based off of the education system. And then on November the 17th, we will have our piano and organ concert, which will feature, as we mentioned, Miss Ashley Peoples and Ronald Trey Watson, who are also the organist for Mount Zion. So we will be doing those things, and you're more than welcome to join us. We are at 1334 29th Street in Washington, D.C. Also, we are online with our webcast, and then we have our Zoom that you can log in on. And also remember, the doors are always open. Mount Zion is always embracing all of the people. And for our future, we look to continue to keep Mount Zion, Georgetown, we're not going anywhere, we'll still be here, to keep Mount Zion up and moving. And that part will take part with us, with our community, as well as our upcoming students, and our future plans that we may have in terms of leading up to the next anniversary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. And Reverend Johnson, your hopes and visions for the future of Mount Zion?
Well, I hope for us to continue the great legacy and continue to be advocates for justice all throughout DC and even in the nation. I look forward to all that they're doing at that cemetery, which I like to call it an African burial ground now because it's a sacred African burial ground, just like the one in New York and the other famous ones around the nation. So we look forward to that. And just growing as a community, growing together and growing, welcoming others in, as Valerie has said. You can join us in person again at our church at 1334 29th Street Northwest. You can join us on Zoom as well. All that information is on our website, mtzionumcdc.org. You can see us on YouTube. If you just type in Mount Zion Georgetown, it'll pop up. You can follow us on Instagram at MOUNT_Zion_DC. So we look forward to connecting with even more people through this special event.
You have Instagram and a QR code with a self-guide. I mean, I think y'all are cutting edge. I mean, a lot of us who ain't quite there yet. So Ms. Green, what are your hopes?
Well, my hopes are that more people will contact us at Mount Zion. We're very willing to give tours, not only of our church, but right around the corner, the parsonage is there. And our parsonage is the birthplace of the first African-American female bishop of the United Methodist Church. And next to that, we have our community house, which is now called the Mount Zion Heritage Center. And we would love to have as many folks as possible to come in and when available, I try to, conduct tours and I'm training a couple of other people to help me in the whole effort.
That's great. And finally, Ms. Walker.
Oh, well, my vision for Mount Zion is I would like to see more of the neighborhood, the surrounding neighborhood, become involved with Mount Zion and maybe more outreach to them, more cross-generational. Whenever we hear a baby cry in Mount Zion, it's like, wow, that's a great sound because we're 208 years old, we had a lot of older members who have now since passed. So to hear a baby in Mount Zion cry, that's music to all of our ears. And so that we can continue with the renovations of the church. You can imagine a church that's 208 years old has a lot of renovations that need to be done. And we've made some great improvement, but there's much more. And that we can continue to raise funds so that and reach out to the community and bring them all involved in our congregation and all of the things that we're trying to do. Mm. So.
Well, I have been enriched by getting to talk to you all today and learn a little bit more about the history of not just Mount Zion, but that's critical history to our city, right? Yeah. And so all of us, no matter if we're connected to the church or to Georgetown, we should know this, right? We should know this this history. And I just thank you and all of your the folks who came before you for all of the work that they did to create not just this institution, but to create positive social justice and change, and to have the foresight to protect the cemetery and, the different things that they were able to do. And congratulations on the sacred places, the support from National Trust for Historic Preservation. That's pivotal and it's great. And I'm so glad that you were able to get that recognition and support. I hope it continues and multiplies. And just I look forward to, many, many anniversaries in the future. I'm going to do my best to be there on Sunday. I encourage the listeners to come along. I saw that you do have an RSVP form on the website, particularly for the luncheon. I know you need a good head count for that. Yes. So folks, if you want to come, go to the website and fill that out. And I want to let you know that this platform is always available to you. So please do, you know, let us know when you want to come back on. And thank you again so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Yes.
So thanks, listeners. We'll be back again next week. And until then, stay tuned for COVID, Race, and Democracy. But first, the news.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. TikTok is one of the most popular social media platforms in the world, with over 1 billion monthly active users. With that popularity, however, has come legal issues. Today, led by California and New York, 13 states, along with the District of Columbia, filed separate lawsuits against TikTok, alleging that the app is, quote, digital nicotine, because it was deliberately designed to keep young people addicted to it. California Attorney General Rob Bonta said, and I quote, TikTok intentionally targets children because they know kids do not yet have the defenses or capacity to create healthy boundaries around addictive content, end quote. The lawsuit said TikTok has contributed to a teen mental health crisis, causing depression and body image issues. Officials in Florida are bracing for the impact of Hurricane Milton, which is expected to be a $1 billion disaster. Milton is now a Category 4 hurricane and is forecast to make landfall tomorrow night as a Category 3 hurricane, somewhere on Florida's central Gulf Coast. Even though the storm is forecast to weaken before making landfall, it will double in size, meaning its disastrous impacts will be felt over a much larger area. Hurricane Milton could come ashore in the Tampa area and become the worst storm to hit that city in over 100 years. With that in mind, officials are pleading with Floridians to evacuate, warning that they face being killed by the storm if they do not leave. Thousands of residents are heeding these warnings, and as a result, highways in the state are clogged and some gas stations are running low or have even run out of fuel altogether. The world of music has lost one of its long-standing contributing voices, Sissy Houston, who passed away yesterday as a result of Alzheimer's disease. Although best known as the mother of Whitney Houston and the aunt of Dionne Warwick, Sissy Houston contributed to gospel and R&B on her own merit. Born Emily Drinkard in 1933, Sissy Houston began her professional career around age 5 with her family's gospel singing group, the Drinkard Singers. She later became a founding member of the R&B group, The Sweet Inspirations, and sang background for several artists, including Aretha Franklin, consistently until at least 2014. Sissy Houston's operatic voice is heard prominently in the background of Aretha Franklin's ballad, Ain't No Way. Houston's voice is also heard on songs like Brown Eyed Girl by Van Morrison, Suspicious Minds by Elvis Presley, and Son of a Preacher Man by Dusty Springfield. Sissy Houston embarked on a solo career in 1970 and in time won 2 Grammy Awards in the traditional gospel album category. She recorded the original version of Midnight Train to Georgia, which was later a #1 hit for Gladys Knight and the Pips. Houston also sang on soundtracks to movies like the 1996 film The Preacher's Wife, featuring her daughter Whitney, and Tyler Perry's 2007 film Daddy's Little Girls. Sissy Houston is survived by several family members, including her sons, Gary and Michael. She was 91 years old. In the D.C. area, Angela Alsobrooks, the executive of Prince George's County, Maryland, is facing a hefty bill after it was discovered that she received property tax credits that she was not qualified for. It was reported that Alsobrooks, who is a United States Senate candidate, inadvertently claimed property tax credits on a home in Washington, D.C. that she had rented out, which previously belonged to her grandmother. The homestead tax credit that she received is meant for a homeowner's primary residence, but Alsobrooks allegedly continued to claim this tax despite renting out the property. For that, D.C. officials issued her a $47,580 bill. A senior advisor to Also Brooks said in a statement that as soon as she was made aware of these tax credits, she took immediate action and is working to pay it back in full. In today's weather, it's currently about 69 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBA.